Hey, welcome to the Mostly Skateboarding Podcast. I'm your host, Templeton Elliott, and I'm joined this week by Patrick Kigongo and Mike Munzenreiter to chat with Jose Vadi, the author of Chipped. Welcome to the show, Jose. How would you describe your new book?
Yeah, my new book, it's called Chipped, Riding from a Skateboarder's Lens, and it's a collection of essays basically exploring my relationship with skateboarding across, you know, from the late 90s to the present. And it's also kind of exploring the different connections that, or like the different kind of worlds that skateboarding opened up to me through skate videos and thus music and everything from urban planning, but also the histories of cities and skate spots. So yeah, it's just kind of like a big exploration of how skateboarding can impact someone's life from childhood through adulthood, and what it's like to kind of look at the future of being a skater from an adult's perspective.
Did you set out to write the book, Jose, with like, were you writing it for a readership that was going to be the general population or skaters, or how did you approach that? I wasn't able to, as a skater, I was like, dang, this could go either way. So how did you approach that? Which audience were you writing for?
I think that was kind of almost the goal, was to write towards an audience that, you know, I think first and foremost, I was kind of trying to write for myself selfishly. Like, what does skateboarding just look like on the page? That was still a question that I was trying to answer through a lot of these, like just drafting these initial attempts at what would become this book, you know? And then through that, it was realizing if I would share this with someone else, do they have enough information, even including some of the things that they don't know, like what a heel flip may look like or doesn't look like? Can they still understand like what I'm trying to get across? And so it was a lot of this book is trying to see what happens when you just write for whoever, you know, about skateboarding. There's definitely some essays where I explain more of the tricks or some of the terminology more than others, but I think across the different essays, I was trying to balance the two while still trying to stay the most authentic to like the essay itself. What is this essay trying to do? And do I want to make the reader work during certain points of the book by way of like just diving into terminology and not explaining anything? Or do I want to kind of, you know, guide the reader through some moments or through some kind of explanations to make a larger point with that clarity? So it was kind of embracing both, you know, and really just, and that's kind of almost the world that I guess I inhabit as a writer. Like I am, you know, a civilian, like a pedestrian, you know, like I'm a non-skater, or to use, you know, quarter snacks terminology, like I lead a secular life, you know, but I also like when it comes to writing, like it's really becomes this playground for me to just kind of try. Every essay is kind of like this different attempt at a different point, but also like a different vibe or a different energy into those pieces. And sometimes that requires or kind of forces the reader to, that requires forcing the reader to kind of go with the flow versus having everything handheld to them.
So Jose, like how did this project come about? I mean, I think as writers, we're all kind of always writing or always thinking about writing and stuff, but how did it come about to be a book?
Yeah, totally. I think, well, you know, this is my second book. My first book was also with the same publisher, Soft Skull Press. And through kind of cold submissions to other literary journals, I met my editor there, Mensa Demary, who's now the editor-in-chief of the press. And, you know, through that relationship of the first book, which is called Interstate Essays from California, we really got to understand, like, my voice as a nonfiction writer. And I got to really work with an editor who cared and really pushed me to see myself in a new light and kind of see what I could do with nonfiction. And that became that book, Interstate. And when we were done with it, I remember both of us were kind of like, this doesn't feel like the end. We still have more work to do in a sense. Like there's still more that we want to talk about. And basically, you know, we want to work on another project together. We realized that pretty quickly. Towards the end of writing Interstate, there's an essay in there called Spot Check. And it's all about me going to San Francisco in a non-sober state of mind and going to a Godzilla movie marathon, quickly leaving that movie marathon and then walking around the Presidio looking for a very specific skate spot, this kind of bump that Sean Sheffy kickflips, I believe, in Mouse. And I think Ben Sanchez is a frontside pop shove it and mouse there as well, and a beautiful 360 flip, as Ben Sanchez does. So I was, you know, that essay kind of allowed me to see myself on the page as a skateboarder and kind of understand, like, when I'm writing about skating, like, this is how it could look, or this is the shape it could take. And I wrote a lot about Hubba Hideout, and to kind of Mike's point, like, breaking down terminology, but also inviting skateboarders into that space and using very much like Taylor making that essay for skaters, like from the jump, I'm immediately talking about Hubba Hideout and using terms that skaters would know, but also kind of exploring that larger reason of why anyone would care about this. Like, why is it important to go find a skate spot? You know, why is it important to, even if you're not going to skate it, right? So from there, myself and Mensa at Soft Skull, you know, we kind of just started talking as we were putting out Interstate. So it was almost like one book begat the other. And Chipped was also heavily edited by Cecilia Flores at Soft Skull Press. Her and Mensa became this Batman and Robin team for me for Chipped, which was great because I had the relationship I started with Mensa now with this other amazing editor who shares the same kind of approach towards editing a writer like myself, who can often go into all types of different directions, you know, in my rough drafts, but that's able to kind of see the larger goal of what I'm trying to express and what I'm trying to get down on the page. And so, you know, working with Cecilia and Mensa on Chipped was something familiar by way of working with Soft Skull, but something new in that Cecilia really pushing me in the revision process. But that's kind of how the book began. So I started writing it around 2021, maybe end of 2020. And Interstate came out in September 2021. Around that time, I relocated from the Bay Area to Sacramento after like many years in the Bay Area. So, you know, Chipped was very much started in the Bay, but a lot of it was written here in Sacramento, about an hour and a half east of the Bay Area for folks that aren't aware. So yeah, like a lot of different changes, like a new editor with on a familiar press, you know, new environment. But that's how the book came about.
I think we gotta go heavy into the skate influences pretty quick here for our listeners, because we're, you know, the writers geeking out on the writing process. Pandemic looms heavy in this book. Yes.
Yes.
The definitely. Writer agrees with me. Good. Yeah. I mean, it seems like a lot of the thinking was coming, like thinking about pandemic times and skating.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Like the Interstate concludes with this, like this kind of postscript that very much references the pandemic. And it kind of addresses almost like the elephant in the room at the time, you know, of like, you know, here's all these essays about me running around bars in San Francisco and going to all these places. And now that's over. I mean, or at least that's like kind of on hold, right? So yeah, it's kind of picking up where that left off through Chipped was very much in the introduction of Chipped, acknowledging that switch, acknowledging that, you know, this relationship with place that's such a very strong part of my writing has kind of shifted. And it really, it's kind of an allusion to the subtitle of the book too, of like writing from the skateboarder's lens, of like exploring and widening my relationship with California by way of this move, you know, forced me to change my relationship with my spaces as a skater. Like I'm no longer a local at any spot. Like everything is new. Everything is extremely vulnerable. The climate is hotter and colder depending on the season, and I have to figure it out, right? And so there's a lot of that vulnerability that I kind of channeled as a writer into Chipped to almost like create a space on the page that felt familiar to me, or like to create a world that, or, you know, maybe just to express all those changes at once, you know, like that was very much a huge part of Chipped, was channeling that vulnerability into something, into writing, really.
So, Jose, something I want to pick up upon, you talk a lot about place, you talk a lot about the places that you grew up, and I think similar to me, you grew up in a suburb of a major American city, even though I believe you were still in L.A. County. You're in Pomona, correct?
Yeah, hanging on by a thread in terms of
exactly.
County.
So for those of you who are unfamiliar with the county's geography, Los Angeles is geographically the United States' largest county by physical size. And Pomona is at the very, very far eastern edge, right next to San Bernardino County. Skateboarders, we know it for Chaffee High School. Something I grappled with as a teenager was this sense of resentment towards the suburbs. I was born uptown in Harlem. And then almost immediately, my parents moved us to Yonkers and then to Rockland across the bridge. And I felt like I was always fighting to get back into the city. And I think a lot of my friends and classmates felt something similar. And I think you, with your exploration of your relationship with LA and then later with San Francisco, both musically, culturally, artistically, it seems like we're probably on a very similar wavelength. How do you reflect upon that time now, especially considering that there are so many skaters and artists who came from very similar backgrounds? Like, we didn't all grow up in cool, poppin' neighborhoods where we knew what was poppin' 24/7.
Yeah, and even that, there's also the technological limitations, right, of growing up in an era, you know, very much pre-social media and, you know, pre-broadband internet and all that, right? And trying to understand space by way of television, by way of radio, by way of newspaper, and then, you know, mixtapes, VHS and cassette, right? So, yeah, I very much felt that energy growing up of like, there's something else out there that I'm missing. Like that before it was FOMO, like you just kind of intrinsically felt like there's a culture, there's just other things that are happening that maybe older kids get to do that I don't get to do. And like skateboarding kind of was one of those things growing up initially. It was like, this is what, you know, older kids get to do, like roam the streets on boards, right? But like, you know, when it came to music and culture, my mom, she grew up in the LA area. And so she's telling me stories about taking the bus cross town from, she grew up near where I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley in the neighborhood of Bassett within La Puente. Shout out to La Puente and El Monte. She grew up out there and she would just take the bus, to your point, Patrick, about distance, all the way from like Mount Sac, which is in Walnut, California, home of the massive rail that Jeff Rowley board slid in Sari. She would take the bus like from way out there, east of east, right, all the way to the west side to UCLA to just go see like the new French film, like the new French New Wave film or something, like the new Truffaut or whatever, right? And my dad grew up in East Harlem, 116 and Park. And
yeah, shout out to Uptown.
You know? And like would tell me all the time about like he would walk by the rehearsal spaces for like Johnny Pacheco and like would go see like some real first generation, what would later be called salsa music, you know what I mean? So growing up with that and like them putting on records for me and describing the 60s and describing the first time they heard certain artists like Aretha Franklin, it was almost like the first time they saw the moon or something, you know, like the way that they would describe it was just like, was super dreamy, you know? And so, and then, you know, you start listening to the radio and MTV was absolutely huge for me and was a complete gateway into film, into music and sex and dance and all sorts of crap. And, you know, like Sex in the 90s, like kept it real, you know, for like a 10-year-old kid, right? You're like, holy
shit. Sex in the 90s was amazing.
Amazing.
This is the thing that kills me, like looking back at that time. Like MTV completely dropped the ball. Jose, on one hand, you're living in San Gabriel Valley, you're living in a suburb of a major city, but also a suburb that is a hotbed of skating in the 1990s, which, as we discussed at Slow Impact 2023, was the absolute peak of America-centric skateboarding. So how has your relationship with skateboarding changed, especially considering that like Chafee High is gone and the IE doesn't have the stranglehold on core skateboarding skate culture that it once did, but it still produces so many amazing skaters.
Yeah, I mean, Samaria Brevard is like holding it down for Riverside. Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot. Like Pomona now has a new skate shop. I think Pawn Shop is opening up from Covina, California, is opening up a location in the YMCA building of Pomona, which is cool. But, you know, Pomona always struggled to have a consistent skate shop. In kind of first generation Barracks, 2008, maybe, they had a really good shop called Platform, but it just fell apart, I guess. But, you know, the scene is strong out there. You know, like Sticks Board Shop is really cool out in Claremont. They have a couple locations around the IE and San Gabriel Valley. And there's more skate parks being built. Like, I think, Patrick, you've skated the new park out in La Puente, you know, which really helps. Like, again, like when you're in the suburbs, isolation is a huge thing that you're constantly trying to break. And skateboarding can get you out into the streets, onto what limited bus lines there are, and get you kind of moving around. And so I think the scene has kind of improved. It might not have like like every skater on Toy Machine might not be from the IE anymore, you know, kind of thing. But like, I think there are still a lot of rippers out there. The loss of Chafee is huge, although it was kind of hit or miss for a while there. Shout out JP Jadid for skating it literally to the dirt.
He's the man. Also, shout out to Pope.
Yeah, right. Yeah, shout out to Pope. The man writes. So like, you know, it's pretty cool to see the kind of people kind of remembering that scene. But it's also, you know, you see like, I think Raisa Leal skated a San Bernardino ledge spot that's been around for years. So you still see some of that pop up. I hope that there's like more historiography around like the pipeline and some of the old 70s skate parks. Like part of the research with Chipped was finding out that in Pomona there was like old skate parks in the 70s and 80s that even, you know, Tony Hawk got to skate before they were bulldozed. Like I knew about them, but I didn't realize where they were. So it was interesting kind of tracing a lot of that history. There's a lot of history in the San Gabriel Valley skateboarding scene that has yet to kind of really been documented and archived. Clyde Singleton actually had some really interesting conversations with Julio de la Cruz about, I think, that kind of area in South LA. And interestingly enough, Tom Kay, a lot of his kind of film-centric spot checking and lurking, he ends up a lot, you know, east of LA in those kind of parts of town. So a lot more people are skating that spot in Second Street, downtown Pomona. It's like a kind of like a bank wall spot. It's like the silvery kind of smooth ground. So you still see Pomona pop up a lot in videos and things like that. But I think what's really interesting about Southern California, though, is how much of a destination it still is. It's like there's a part of me that wonders why anyone would move to LA anymore to be a pro skater. Not that everyone can be Dick Rizzo, but, you know, you can skate where you're at and really make a mark. And I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about how, like, in the wake of like Chafee being gone and all these other things, and even like seeing Pioneer like in Upland still getting skated, you know, the bank spot from time to time, I just wonder, like, is SoCal like a kind of spot that you pass through as you are a pro skater, or is it still like a destination? Maybe not a point for this conversation, but just kind of something I've been thinking a lot about, you know, because like, I don't know. San Diego used to be the epicenter in the 90s, and now it's like skate mafia and like people training for the Olympics. You know, like it's not like everyone. It's not like Steve Olsen's out there with Muska anymore. But
which is a
maybe
tragedy.
I'm rambling.
But at the same time, there is an interesting parallel between being a skateboarder and being a pilgrim in any religious faith. We go to these spots because they're part of our history, they're part of our lineage, they're part of the culture. And we can have all kinds of conversations about whether or not it's still relevant to move to California to make it in skateboarding. But think about, skating is more global than ever now, and people still think about coming here. And the industry is still centered in Southern California and in the Bay Area for the most part. And so if you're wanting to penetrate media, unfortunately, or fortunately, you got to come here.
Yeah, I think it's the industry is what pulls people there. And then also just like you want to be around a bunch of skaters, go to Southern California. You know, you ride for a company and you make friends with people who ride for that company. And it just, there's just like a draw. All your friends are out there, so you might as well go out there too instead of staying in Richmond or something.
Richmond is tight though.
It is tight, but it does have its limits.
That's true. It's great. It's very true. And like LA, I mean, not to hate on anyone moving to LA to be a skater, it's like really, I mean, I definitely get it. It's a great place to be, you know. And but kind of, I think part of this question too, I've been thinking about it a lot in the context of Ed Templeton and his ongoing obsession around suburbia and Huntington Beach. And there's an essay in the book called Programming Injection that is all about Ed Templeton's impact on me and my perspective around art and writing and skateboarding. As a kid, it seemed like he was raising the flag and saying, you can talk about suburbia in these artistic ways, even though it's a bland, often kind of boring and depressing area. You can talk about it and describe the nuances therein. And as a kid, that really kind of gave me kind of a green light to recognize where I was at in different ways and to be kind of grateful for where I grew up. You know, there's a lot of times where I wish I grew up in LA, like I wish I grew up in Los Feliz or freaking like downtown, even though no one lived downtown back then. But like, you know, like if I live closer to the mid city, you know, like that'd be so sick. But, you know, I think like at Templeton and getting into skateboarding and music around that time and discovering him through Welcome to Hell and Toy Machine, that kind of gave me this crazy green light to, you know, think about my space in new ways and think about the San Gabriel Valley in a different way.
Well, to your point about Ed Templeton, I think it's important to remember that Huntington Beach is one of the most lowercase and uppercase C conservative cities in the nation and one of the most reactionary places. And so what an amazing place to be an artist to document that kind of all of the contradictions that you see from city council meetings to seeing signs everywhere reminding you that there's a curfew or the fact that there are surf Nazis and skate Nazis. You know, I remember popping Welcome to Hell into the VHS in 1996, had just come back from Uganda, had been there all summer, no skateboarding whatsoever. And most of us need someone to run our personal lives. You know, the song by Lard and the American flag waving in the background, it was like seeing a reflection of, you know, my little suburb of New York City in that kind of like, oh my God, it's horrifying, but you know, this is an actual reality. And I think Ed Templeton as an artist was a gateway drug for a lot of us. I remember he won the Venice Biennale in the early aughts, and I was fascinated by that. I was like, oh, he's an artist. He's a photographer's photographer. But kind of like zooming out and opening the question up to the floor and still talking about skateboarding, there's been quite a bit of chatter about how this year is the 30th anniversary of Supreme, and 10 years ago, Supreme put out Cherry. And that really set the template for the next decade, and skating goes through its phase in. And now it feels like we're starting to see the rumblings of a post-Cherry era. So starting with Jose and then branching out to Mike and to Templeton, what can we expect next from skating?
Oof, this is a good question. Well, it's funny, like the small brands are getting big and then they're splintering off into other small brands, right? Like as we're seeing with this kind of, and you know, some of the skaters aren't skating as much or they're getting into other things, but I'm curious, what I'm hopeful to see, and I think we're seeing with definitely Palace and their collaborations, as well as Weekend and their productions with videos, as well as some of the hockey edits, the FA hockey edits that Benny Magliano's doing. I feel like we're going to see more like production in skateboarding, like in terms of quality of like what a, like almost like film work, you know, and maybe not on Jim Greco's level with Tobin and whatnot, which are like amazing projects, and with Joey Cinco, but you know, I feel like there's going to be more of like embracing that in skating. And I don't know, like in terms of its presentation through skate videos, you know, which Cherry was, right? Like Cherry is Strobeck, you know, totally, you know, it's a watershed moment, right? He's still doing his thing and you're seeing the style kind of evolve even in the most recent, like, I believe he shot the most recent Supreme edit with Tyshawn overseas. But like, you know, you're kind of seeing like him experiment with like, what his post-Cherry era is as well, you know what I mean? So I don't know, but I feel like there's gonna be like more like production, maybe more skits, which almost speaks to like early 90s girl, you know, or mid to late 90s girl when Spike Jonze had some, you know, music video money.
Yeah, I think my default answer before I heard Jose's answer was like, how would I know? Like skating just does what it does. But I really like that thread of more, you know, higher production value and just more interesting things and production value in general going into it. Like for a long time, I've been trumpeting like Weekend's skits and the thought put into, you know, as goofy as their fucking stuff can be at times, just kind of the thought and the humor put into it. And that all goes back to production. So I think that's a really good idea of the direction that, I don't want to say it should take, but I'd be happy to see it go there. If I'm trying to think of what skating as the act is going to do, I have no idea. I would like to see it kind of unstick itself from the amalgamation of like pretty sweet combos and I don't know. Yeah, I feel it's more trend driven than it has been for a while, because of Instagram and the flattening of culture and all that. But I like the idea of more production value. Templeton, are we on to anything?
Gosh, I hope so. I mean, I think that for a long time we've been in like a low production value kind of scenario where it's just like slap the tricks on a timeline, throw a music track under it and post it, you know, like no names, no intros, no real editing, just like put push it out there. And I think that it's kind of devalued skate videos and skate media. And hopefully we'll see like a revaluing of skate media. You know, we've got like Closer. Fuck, I don't know.
Yeah, Closer.
Yeah. And just I think that we're going to see maybe more like a revaluing of skate media. How about that for a prediction?
I like it. I think now might be a good time to see if Jose would scroll to the bottom of our podcast document, picked out a excerpt from the book. And I don't know. I think I put enough details in there. I was like, yeah, can you intro the, I don't want to say clip, Jesus, skateboard brain. But I don't know. I was reading, I hit you up on Instagram because that's where we talk unofficially and wanted to know what your favorite essay out of the book was. And you said this one. And then I was reading this and it's fantastic. And I think, I don't know, I tried to pick out something that kind of like embodies skateboard riding and then, you know, you touch on so much else. So I'll give it over to you, man.
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, this essay is called King Shit or Can a King Be a King? It's mostly about Sun Ra, the composer, jazz musician, you know, and his kind of legacy. But it's also about finding jazz through skate videos, examples of Sun Ra and others like John Coltrane's music and skate videos. So yeah, I'll be reading from, it's a big essay, and I'll be reading from like the first couple pages. At the height of the pandemic, I'd sit on the wood platform dividing me and my neighbor's side doors and stare at the sky above. This landing is my front yard, backyard, break room, conference center, wellness retreat destination, and, on wildfire nights, a charcoal sauna. I listen to Raw on my headphones on the now digitally streaming intergalactic tunes and think about that morning skate session and what I wanted to try and learn tomorrow. And then I'd wonder if I were sick and breathe in the air, reminding me I'm outside. And I'd imagine the orchestra playing these tunes, Raw orchestrating by pointing at different members of the ensemble. I'd carry these sunset dreams into the next skate session, imagining the orchestra awaiting me at the curbs, already sweating, an hour into this hypothetical, time-bending skate session. So what spaces would Ra's heel flips inhabit? Would these heel flips traverse? Maybe Ra would make a manhole cover rise slowly from the ground with his telekinetic powers, if only to heel flip that much higher over it. New challenges for this mortal's playground. Such interstellar skate demonstrations by Ra would precede a brief poetry sermon regarding physics, discipline, space, time, universes, pharaohs, before devoting the rest of the evening to music, thus ending the skate demo slash experience somewhere in the afterlight of an immeasurable day, and I have to say somewhere and not some time because it is the place that creates space, and space is the place, as Ra has proclaimed many times before. A dance, then. With Ra skating, a choreography speaking from a future faraway land, the place from which Ra was abducted in a dream, a place resembling Saturn, according to Ra, before being returned to what his family refers to as Alabama. Ra decided still to continue his intergalactic journey through the Keys, yes, but maybe he also started waxing curbs, slapping the shit out of Birmingham sidewalks en route to rehearsal, landing perfect heel flips between gigs like a double palm scream of ivory keys.
Okay, Jose.
Hold on. I'm snapping into my... And that all would have been first try had I not copy and pasted so hastily. That was sick.
Yeah, oh, that was a...
Jose, I got to tell you, so I was home alone when I read this. I was actually shouting. I was actually shouting, not just when I read this passage, but this particular chapter. You talking about Sun Ra. We have a mutual friend, homegirl, Farah Hassan, my one-time DJ partner.
Big shout out.
Yeah. And yo, because we used to talk about Sun Ra quite a bit. And I first heard Coltrane in Gonza's part in Video Days. And mm-hmm. So to see jazz, but specifically this particular era, I mean, it feels criminal just to call it free jazz because Sun Ra literally was on another planet. What is it about jazz and skating that works so well together? Whether it's Video Days or a visual sound, there was a short video that just came out a little while ago from a crew. I want to say in St. Louis, we can include it within the show notes. What is it about these two? I mean, they're art forms and they're very free and yet they're also very anchored in tradition and standards. But like, what is it to you about skating and jazz that just works so well together?
I think skating and jazz and music, but particularly jazz in general, I think the role of improvisation and the relationship with space, I think, are huge kind of components. You know, I think the improvisational aspect of jazz is kind of intrinsic into its live performance, right? And knowing what a song is in terms of how it's recorded or how it looks on sheet music is one thing, but to bring it to life and to add your own kind of chapter to the story by way of its performance is just really interesting and really, I don't know, I always found it akin to other types of performances like skateboarding, you know. And you know, the style within certain skaters being so bombastic, like it just always reminded me of music. Like you can't see Quim Cardona skate in silence, right? Like that guy has like rhythm and like movement every time this guy like carves, you know what I mean? Like this dude looks amazing. And same with so many other skaters, right? Like, and you know, obviously skateboarding lives and breathes in the visual as much as the oral, you know, space. Like sonics is a huge component of skateboarding, and the sound of, like, you know, you hear like skaters from the 70s talking about when like ball bearings were added and, you know, the urethane wheel and how things sounded different, you know, in addition to feeling different. And so all those things combined, I don't know, I was just really intrigued by things like stereo and the role of music. And also, you know, when stereo was coming out too, it was jazz, you know, included in the edits and in the brand direction, right? A lot of Verve and Blue Note Records, Prestige Records were kind of influencing the art direction, right? But it was also them themselves homebrewing their own jams and presenting those as, you know, in conversation with those other pieces, you know what I mean? Specifically thinking about like Matt Rodriguez skating to Tommy Guerrero and things like that. You know, that is very powerful seeing, you know, you being the maestro of your own skate part. So I think jazz, you know, in that role of improvisation, there's that relationship. But also, you know, by way of researching Sun Ra and particularly jazz musicians in New York from, you know, the 40s into the 60s, the restriction of space and the role of cabaret cards and negating opportunity of jazz musicians and that creativity, you know, that which was very much had like racist undertones as much as classist undertones.
Real quick, could you break down the cabaret card? Because I got an idea of it reading the full piece, but I think listeners could use the breakdown.
Yeah, so it was a permit. It was an identification card that much almost like a liquor license a business would need to serve alcohol. A musician like a Billie Holiday or a, you know, Miles Davis would need a permit that was required of all jazz musicians in nightclubs, specifically in New York City.
And approved by whom? Approved by whom?
Yeah, there was this guy, it was like this, I forgot the name of the division, but it was like, it was almost like this, like basically the cops, you know what I mean? You know, between the NYPD working with, you know, whatever administration within the city, it was easy to clamp down on, you know, some of the most vulnerable populations, which are, you know, musicians and you know, kind of like Vice Squad, right? And this lasted from Prohibition into the 60s, you know, into like, I think like 66 or 67.
Oh, no, it was further. It was only in 2017 that Mayor de Blasio repealed the cabaret laws. And to provide some additional context, the thing about cabaret laws that was particularly infuriating was that a bar without a cabaret license could not have dancing. And so in a book that came out a few years ago called Never Be Alone Again about the Bloghouse era, if bar owners or managers thought that NYPD or the Vice Squad was going to come in on a cabaret raid, they would turn off whatever DJ was DJing and immediately throw on something from Radiohead's Kid A. This was during the peak hipster era, so that first of all, people would immediately stop dancing. That's very much a headphones record. And second of all, to remove any kind of plausibility that somebody would be grooving in there. Anyway, yeah, it was particularly bad, and it was very much pointed at Black and Latino people across the city, but also gay bars as well. And you could probably have a whole other conversation about it. But Jose, to your point about cabaret laws being used to restrict space, I think the genius of jazz, very much like the genius of skateboarding, is within limitations. And there's probably like a whole bunch of parallels too about, you know, you think about jazz musicians who were celebrated overseas, very much like the stories of the first American pros to go to Europe or to go to Japan. And you're doing demos for huge amounts of people. Meanwhile, back home, everyone's throwing things at you and swearing at you in the street.
And Jimi Hendrix, you know, making it big overseas first before coming back home, you know. But yeah, like, I think it's a huge, I think, like, those are some of the things I was thinking about with jazz music. And, you know, Sun Ra was performing, you know, between his life in Birmingham, Chicago, New York to Philly. You know, in that Chicago era, he was playing behind, you know, the laws in that area were that, you know, the dancers, burlesque dancers, were in front of a curtain behind which a predominantly, you know, like an all-black band is playing to a predominantly white audience. And he would go in, I think in one particular venue, he would go like across the street or between floors and do different gigs for different audiences. So, you know, yes, jazz is improvisation, but during that, you know, big band era, it was like delivering a very specific disciplined sound for a dancer and vis-a-vis that audience, right? So it plays that spectrum. And I think Sun Ra was really inspiring to me because as I dove deeper into the history and, you know, by way of the pandemic, more artists are using services like Bandcamp to try and get, you know, a better percentage of their sales. So I was on Bandcamp and going through the Sun Ra Orchestra's archive, which is extremely well maintained by the folks that are helping to digitize and represent the music respectfully and legally. I just kept diving into different parts of his eras, and all of them were kind of in response to where he was physically playing, you know, Chicago, New York, and eventually by the 70s, Philadelphia, where the orchestra still resides. So, you know, and then obviously space is the place, you know, the movie that featuring Sun Ra, the name of the biography about Sun, all these things were very much front and center when you start to engage with, you know, his discography.
One of the things kind of building off, you know, a fantastic essay about Sun Ra and him as a skater. I just love the imaginings of him as a skater, man. But, you know, so many of the other essays, they are about skating, but then they branch off into real world things that contextualize and or relate to. They contextualize the skating that's happening. Let's say, like, you know, mid-90s world videos, LA riots, the OJ Simpson trial, and or then get into just other things that happen in the world. I'm forgetting my other example, darn it. Is it your natural tendency to think in terms of both, okay, I've got the skate essay, I'm doing a hand thing, I'm like one hand into the other, like making a point. Are you writing the skate essay? Or, and then you're like, okay, how do I relate this to the wider world? Or when you're writing, are you naturally going from like, okay, here's where we are in skating, and then here's context that I just can't get out of my head? I guess it's a process question, like, did that come easily or not?
No, that's the challenge, is like, can I get this idea on the page, period? And I compare it a lot to like a three-man weave in basketball, or a three-player weave in basketball, where you have these different ideas that are trying to like braid themselves into this cohesive thing. And what about these different current events or these different pop cultural moments or these different historic moments in pop culture, for that matter? Like, what about these things connects to Kareem Campbell and, you know, skating to Nas, If I Ruled the World? You know, it's I think context is so critical to really understanding the power of certain moments in skateboarding's history, both in terms of the physical landscape, the tools that we're using, you know, like the state of the toy beneath our feet, but also like, what was it to be a black man in Los Angeles, LA, in that time? In the eyes of police, in the eyes of politicians, you know, like, think, what was it like to be a brown kid at Lockwood in that neighborhood, period, just walking around the streets circa like, you know, 95 to 2000, or, you know, throughout the 90s. I feel like certain skaters apoliticize skateboarding to try and make it solely about the act, but the act itself exists within a built environment and the environment that is our world. And that world has, you know, racism, misogyny, classism, and all those things. And so I can't ignore the world that we live in when writing anything about skateboarding. So I think that's my approach, is kind of like ethnographic in terms of personal experience, and also trying to have use historical moments to help ground non-skaters into these skateboarding moments a little bit too. Like maybe they've heard Nas, maybe they remember when that came out too, or they were sitting on the couch watching the music video like I was as a kid, but they don't know about Kareem, they don't know about the switch hard flip over the bumped picnic table, you know, they don't know the rawness of wearing white cargo pants while doing so. But like I can at least bring in other cultural moments to help relate the risks of being a black skateboarder on the streets of LA during that time. And there's enough solid reporting and amazing journalism out there that I'm like privileged to cite and to reference to try and make these arguments as, you know, stronger, but also again, they're very much personal essays. So finding the moments when I can see myself in the essays as well. Like, you know, thinking about Sun Ra doing these heel flips is my daydream that allows you to kind of talk about the pandemic, set the scene of me, you know, trying to find peace at night. But it's a daydream, you know, within a nonfiction piece. So like even bending the rules and trying to understand what I can do within an essay or what I can do within nonfiction, that's just the challenge of writing that I put upon myself, really. But, you know, it's also natural instinct to just want to weave want to try and build these strands together. But I also do writing, you know, freelance writing that's way more kind of straightforward, I would say, you know, like book reviews or artist profiles. But even within that, I try to, you know, try not to ignore the world surrounding like the people or places or things that I'm writing about.
I was struck by real quick. I was struck by two things, both relating to your mom, her appreciating the Nas line. Maybe you can fill us in.
Open every cell in Attica, send him to Africa.
Yeah. Yeah. Watching Trilogy. And then just also her worries about you just being a kid out there and knowing how harsh the world is. I mean, I don't know. Yeah.
She grew up in, I said Bassett earlier to kind of rep the neighbor, like to kind of shout it out because it's a pretty rough part of town in La Puente, you know what I mean? And it's a very specific, if you know, you know, kind of place, and
right,
East Harlem as well. And so we were in an immigrant, you know, product of immigrant household. Like we were definitely raised to be aware. Patrick, you frequently bring up in social media, like moving to LA and people not realizing the colors they're wearing. You know what I mean? Even in 2024, if you know, you know, and you need to be aware. So it's like growing up, even in the cuts of LA County, we, you know, you're aware of those things too. And so yeah, I found out years later that my mom would actually follow me to certain skate spots when I started skating. Like when I started leaving the house solo to go to like wherever, and I would go somewhere else.
Was that in the book or was that in?
No,
I said that in. Okay,
damn. That might be on the cutting room floor. But
mom was lurking.
She was lurking, and she has an amazing LA mind state. Like she is a self-proclaimed LA girl. You know what I mean? Like. And so she was lurking shout out to moms, like she was being a parent, you know what I mean? And over time we developed enough trust where, you know, like that wasn't happening and whatnot, but she was scared. I mean, like there's a lot of things going on around that time. Proposition 187 that Governor Pete Wilson is proposing, in addition, you know, years after the riots and all sorts of stuff. I mean, gangster rap is like the number one thing on Billboard, but it's also like the number one fear in, you know, America's hearts. You know, I want to sound cliche, but like it was also like this huge fear, right?
She was very real. I think that menace epically latered opened up a lot of people's eyes. You know, when you go back and rewatch those clips from that era, from any video, you realize it's probably about 20, maybe 30 people max who you regularly see skating at Lockwood, and not many more, because it was La Mirada Loco's territory. And so you fast forward to 10 years ago, and I moved two blocks away. What a different world it was, because of gang injunctions and because, you know, we spent most of the 1990s just basically locking everybody up. But, you know, coming back around to skateboarding and kind of thinking about it like in this, how multifaceted it is and the way that you're able to express it like this, I just can't help but feel like your writing would work so well in Slap if Slap was still with us. And
man,
Templeton and Mike, you know, you've both been in the skate publishing and media world for quite some time. I feel like we need a magazine like Slap that has a little bit of art and music and culture in the kind of way that Jose has presented it to us, because that's what the game is missing to me. I feel like I got put onto so much cool stuff from Slap because I got my National Geographic style skate photos in Transworld, and I got my raw shit from Thrasher. But Slap was where I really went to expand my mind. Like, is there space in skateboarding for that? Because I would pay good money for that.
I think we're seeing better and better content, you know, and long form stuff out there. You know, we got to give a big shout out to, I mean, a lot of different print publications that I think are doing it. I mean, like the level of the quality of interviews that you're seeing in Closer, the long form that you're seeing consistently through Free Skate, you know, like they published Sam Corman's article that was massive, you know, that he presented at Slow Impact last year with photos. And, you know, you got to give it to them. Like that's a big thing to print as a print publication and present online as well. So I think we're seeing more of it. And even just skaters just being comfortable talking about different things, you know, Kwasi from Sci-Fi being comfortable presenting motion graphics through his social as well as like his skateboarding, right? His amazing skateboarding, excuse me. But, you know, I think you're seeing more of it, you know, and books is kind of an interesting, I mean, books is an interesting lane for me. I don't think I can deliver a newsletter like Cole Nowicki, you know, in Simple Magic, but that exists. And that's a weekly, there's a lot of weekly things that we receive as skateboarders that are pretty high quality these days. And so I think we're getting there, you know, and I don't know what that there is, if it's a journal or something, or just more of these kind of types of storytelling. But I mean, and you guys are part of that too. And a big shout out to Mike and Templeton. I grew up, but as a 20-something reading the skateboard mag, it was always a treat reading your guys' stuff. I totally geeked out on Mike Munzenreiter at Slow Impact 1 last year, and I will do so again on this podcast. Edits be damned. But, like, yeah, I really enjoyed you guys' writing. Yeah, straight up, you guys are them, and I really enjoyed your guys' writing coming up. So, but yeah, like, I think everything kind of begets, like, the next thing, right? And that Nat Geo Transworld era begat the skateboard mag, and then kind of low-key begat, you know, Closer in a sense, in a distant sense, I guess. But the cool thing about skateboarding, and I'm paraphrasing, I think, Ted Barrow here, is how cool skaters are in terms of supporting one another. Like, by way of Chipped, I had to reach out. There's a 2-page spread of a spread that Ed Templeton did in Transworld for Programming Injection, his briefly lived kind of brain floss adjacent column. It's similar to what you see now with the Gons and Thrasher, like his 2-page abnormal communication thing, but for Transworld in the 90s. And I had to reach out to Jamie Owens, who put me out, into Blair Alley, who all within 24 hours gave me the language I needed for the credit within the book, you know. And it was just like a testament to skaters who kind of care about the culture and want to contribute to it in some capacity, me being a nerd and a writer, and or however you kind of fit in or contribute. Like, it's just amazing, by way of doing this, like seeing even just like those small but big moments of support within the community, and this conversation included.
I gotta say, you know, thanks for the kind words, Jose. That was, yeah, I'd forgotten about that because you told me that, but, you know, more so I just want to shout out the time, you know, we were in Kyle's car, Kyle Beachy's car, in the In-N-Out drive-through listening to the Lyricist Lounge CD. And I tripped on just how, like, we all, guys from disparate places in the country and all this, and varying ages, but by a little bit. But, you know, we all geeked out on this CD like I hadn't heard in 15, 20 years. And
you don't bump it every weekend?
I lost it, man. And it's not I don't think it's on Apple. I'm on Apple.
None of that stuff is on streaming.
and I don't know. There was something about how, yeah, we're all from various places, various backgrounds, finding the same place in hip hop via, because I don't know if that was a Raucous release, but we found the same place in hip hop and same place in interests via the skate thing and via the same ages that we were in.
Yeah,
it's gonna tie this in better.
Well,
yeah,
no, and like skate videos and skateboarding is just like such a huge gateway into so many different cultures. Like the first time I heard Jungle Brothers was in a 411 clip. I can clearly remember being introduced to Dr. Octagon through Edward De Vera's 411 profile. Like, I clearly remember getting into, I mean, I remember learning the word cutlery through a Bjork song. You know what I mean? Like music is such a huge, like, guiding force in skateboarding, and so, and as is writing. So I don't know, like, I feel like, but yeah, that's the cool thing about skateboarding. And part of the thing that encourages me to thread through the writing is like, here's a dude, like, I mean, it's almost like a bar joke, right? Like a dude who grew up in SoCal, a dude who grew up in Minneapolis, and a guy in St. Louis end up in a Jaguar in Tempe, Arizona, trying to get in and out, you know what I mean? And like, that's the kind of thing that skateboarding can bring together. But I think is also in conversations with other types of performance, like sketch comedy, which has, you know, improvisational components to it, stuntman shit that you're even seeing like Paul Macnow and all those dudes doing. Like, it's such a performative kind of bombastic act, you know what I mean, when you skateboarding, that it's so interesting the ways that skaters can kind of like naturally go into other arenas, but how as a culture we're still so hesitant to talk about that fact. Or, you know, and I think that's what you're starting to see change, you know, like Jankum doing documentaries on a skateboard adjacent, you know, soccer crew, you know, that's like disciplined and playing like year after year and like is committed to this thing just as we are to skateboarding. Like, you know, Epically Latered still being around is kind of a, you know, is like fucking amazing, you know. But to your question about like, what do we need, Patrick, I think like Slow Impact also provides an interesting model too, where this year the paper skaters, you know, we're presenting like super academic papers around how using Google Maps to track skate spots, Max Neely's presentation around like dance and skateboarding, like all that stuff is really helping to push the boundaries, so to speak, of like how we talk about this thing.
This thing of ours, which should never be mentioned by name.
Yeah, Jose, I found so many of the things you wrote about to be so relatable, you know, like kind of like what you were saying. We're all from different places and slightly different times, and we all kind of had similar experiences, you know, like going to demos, watching Welcome to Hell, reading Ed Templeton stuff. I don't know if I really have a question, but it's just like, that was the thing that struck me most about the book, is just kind of how universal skateboarding can be. And I'm sure even people outside of our era, maybe it wasn't Welcome to Hell, maybe it was something else, another video, maybe it was Cherry, that gave them that same kind of, or a similar kind of,
like, questionable
into the world. Yeah, or questionable, yeah, or Search for Animal Chin, or whatever.
Yeah, when I hear, like, skaters who were impacted by videos like that, you know, where there's kind of, like, a before and after, it kind of empowers me to talk about, you know, this, I guess this like 1996 generation, where it's like Trilogy, Welcome to Hell, Mouse, you know, and that's kind of like almost like this basis to talk about, that begins like this new era. But I'm glad it felt relatable, because oftentimes, and I studied history in college, and so like history is such a short accordion, you know, and so like to write about things that are very recent or very, that feel very recent, I get very like hesitant about it, you know, like, wasn't, you know, 1996 feels like very long, but also very recent, you know, depending on the day, I guess. But there's sometimes when you like, you read something about your culture or about, you know, your time and place in history, and you're like, that's not necessarily it, you know what I mean? And there was like, and I'm not trying to throw shade at other writers, but like, there was a lot of times when the eras that we're talking about were get articulated on the page or in a podcast, and you're like, that's not it necessarily, you know what I mean?
I get what you're saying about the immediacy of like the recent past, or the difficulties of writing about the immediate past and history. And I don't know, that's a whole avenue that we could get into maybe on part two of this podcast, since we're going really long.
Oh, sorry.
I felt like the way the pandemic is kind of threads through the book of essays, I don't know, it felt immediate, but it was relatable. Granted, I started skating in 95. You started skating in 96. And I'm pretty darn sure that, you know, enhanced the enjoyment I had reading the essays. But, you know, skateboarding's immediate. I feel like you can write about skateboarding that is relatable across generations because of the commonalities, and then have the specific time frames. And those commonalities will help make it work for people who aren't thinking of Trilogy as that pivotal video.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can go backwards and forwards in time, and skating's history is so relatively compact in the great sprawl of things. I think you can get away with it.
Well, yeah. And like, Rockridge Curves is a great example of that, you know, where that's been a street skate spot. That's been a spot since the 80s. And it's still, you know, a quintessential skate spot. And as a pedestrian just passing through there, you can immediately get an idea of what skateboarding is or what it entails. You know what I mean? You can see that some people are kind of bashing into a curb and some people are popping. You know what I mean? Like, you can understand the physics, you know, through this, just the public performance of that spot. Yeah. And I think by way of that, so much of riding sometimes, there's kind of a beauty in encouraging the reader to kind of go along with your worldview and by way of that, your language. And leaning into that in different moments of Chipped was pretty fun. And there is an essay about the Rockridge Curbs called Curbs, surprise. That's all about, there's moments in that essay where I'm like taking a break between doing like sloppy runs, you know, like Rockridge, you kind of go end to end on the islands, so to speak, and just kind of observing the locals and saying what's up through like nods or hellos, you know, and, you know, they understand that they should probably walk on this side of the parking lot to not get destroyed, you know, and then like, or they understand that they're going to cut through and, you know, skaters are just going to have to wait. Right. So it's interesting just kind of in those moments where we coexist and there isn't any type of, you know, everyone's kind of understanding the rules of engagement of that space in a sense, and everyone's, you know, kind of allowed to coexist. And trying to transfer that feeling into writing is fun, like navigating when to explain or not to explain a trick, or just kind of, or describe a metal band as like stoner metal, and just, you know, people just have to understand what that feels like or sounds like, or you know, trying to describe that as well is super fun in different moments of the band, of the book as well.
You almost made me nostalgic for the high pandemic when nobody knew what the fuck was going on and it was scary and shitty, but there was also that, like, you know, going out in public in places that everybody had deemed safe, and your Rockridge Curbs, I don't know, my downtown Minneapolis on Nicollet Mall, where it was just kind of like, all right, everybody needs to be here. We're going to make this work. And it was different than normal society. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think like people were able to see space differently. And like, next thing you know, like the local community group is blocking off the curbs to teach kids how to do bike lessons, and skaters are just going to have to work around that. You know what I mean? Like, that was a part of the pandemic too, which was cool. Yeah, I think people, and there was also like, you know, a lot of the protests going on at the time, there's this reawakening or this kind of analysis of space and how it gets constricted, you know, during different times. But yeah, it's the past 4 years, talk about time as an accordion or a flat circle. I mean, everything is so warped and we're still recovering from a lot of that. And it definitely alters your consideration of time and space.
Yeah, I feel like I'm still trying to figure out the post-pandemic world.
Is there like an overarching, do you think there was an overarching theme to your book, Jose?
I guess the overarching theme of the book is just how much skateboarding creates this lens and that allows a skater like myself to have these conversations with other skaters, you know, whether it's around music or space, you know, it becomes like just such a worldview and also like a compass by which or through which you like navigate the world. So I think that's the main thread, is that skateboarding is a culture, and it's also this worldview that shapes not just your relationship with skate spots and the built environment, but, you know, it becomes another lens through which you see different parts of your world, and if not every aspect of your daily life, it just becomes another filter by which you navigate your everyday.
Final question for you, Jose. Why is the music in skate videos right now so bad?
Oh man, yeah, I don't know. It's rough out there for maybe music rights, I don't know. But I mean, it's so much of the screamo is having a resurgence in general, like the 20-year anniversary tours are, you know, selling out city by city. And I don't know. I mean, it's tough. I've been watching a lot more skate videos on mute, but to each their own. And I, you know, the folks got to go through that phase, apparently. It is cool sometimes to see some stuff like pop up that from that era. That's pretty cool. But yeah, I don't know. It's not my cup of... Not my choice. I do think, who do you think is like killing it in terms of like soundtracks lately? Like, I think the FA hockey videos, like those soundtracks are just are pretty great, you know?
I mean, Paul Young stuff is always good. Obviously Palace, supreme when they care, but you know, that's a little bit unfair. You know, it's like, oh, it's basically like New York, London are running things. I mean, I think my big beef is with a lot of the very, what I call anonymous cold wave and IPA indie. There's just kind of, it's the kind of thing that could be just humming in the background. And I understand that its rights and clearances are a huge blocker to making the soundtrack of your dreams, but there's so much music out there. I sometimes worry that there's skateboarders who are not getting into music enough and that they're just focused on skateboarding, and then they end up getting into stuff way late, sometimes where they miss seeing these acts live and that they miss really experiencing them. You know, there's that from like 14 to, I say 14 to 24 is an incredibly formative and powerful time for music, but especially like your late teens, early 20s. My God, I remember I met this dude years and years and years ago in Marseille, and he said something that kind of blew my mind, because we were talking about the Strokes, and this was 2003, and I wasn't feeling them back then. And I only have recently come to peace with their existence. And this dude, he told me something that really messed up my whole head. He said, you know, sometimes there's a band that will change your life. They will change the way that you dress, the books that you read, the records that you buy, the bands that you go see, maybe even the food that you eat. And for me, that band is the Strokes. And I had to give him mad respect for that. In fact, I still have a photo of him. Maybe I'll find this guy on social media someday. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, if you're not listening to music in your late teens, early 20s, I feel like you're missing out. But we could probably have a whole conversation just about music, and probably should.
Yeah, that's for the companion podcast. Well, I think we've gone pretty long here. I don't have a smooth transition into the stoked on portion, but Jose, what are you stoked on this week?
Well, thanks for having me, y'all. Super appreciate it. I'm stoked on, it's spring. We're having a ball as live spring. NCAA, NWA, and NBA are going full tilt right now, playoff and March Madness. So I'm stoked on that. I'm very stoked on Cole Nowicki. He has a new book out. It has an amazing title called Laser Quit Smoking Massage. It's a collection of nonfiction. He had a launch party in Vancouver recently, and we get to read together in Berkeley, California in 2 weeks. So stoked on that. And stoked on Creative Growth, an amazing arts nonprofit in Oakland who has an exhibit at the SF MoMA. This is a group that works with persons with disabilities, and the SF MoMA has acquired like dozens of their works, if not hundreds. So it's a big deal, if not unprecedented deal. So I'm super stoked to check it out. Skaters might remember Creative Growth. They did a collab with Alzheimer's a few years back. That was really cool to see. Patrick, what are you stoked on?
Well, this week I am stoked on Spitfire Wheels. I've been digging into the Clash's Sandinista again. The nice thing about a 3-album set is that you can pick up at a different point and have a totally different experience from the last time that you listened to it. I, too, have been enjoying both men's and women's NCAA basketball. My God, what a week, and very hyped for the weekend. As of today, recording on Wednesday, Arsenal are at the top of the Premier League, but we'll see how long that lasts. I'm very stoked because next week, as part of a celebration of 10 years of meeting, my wife and I are going to Japan. I've never been to Asia. I've never been to Japan. I'm trying to link up a warm girl in Osaka, and I'm definitely going to be looking for cool pants. And on a more somber note, rest in peace, James Hardy, who tragically passed away a few days back. Go back and dig into a bunch of his old reel parts. A real one for real, no pun intended. Mike, what are you stoked on this week?
I am about a week late in reporting on this, exactly a week late, in fact. Skate Twitter denizen Zach Harris's appearance on the Long Form podcast from last week, now said week a couple times. For those not familiar immediately with Zach, he writes about weed, bowling, skateboarding in this appearance on the Long Form podcast, which has had some, you know, top shelf writers, reporters, journalists on it. They talk about the industry, they talk about process, they talk about progress, all that. Zach is talking about a bowling feature he had in Rolling Stone, and he's not necessarily talking about how much it relates to skating, but it sure as hell does. It's an interesting listen, and I recommend it. Stoked on that. Templeton, what are you stoked on this week?
I also really enjoyed that long form episode with Zach Harris. Great show, and like really insightful into Zach, who's somebody that I've never really talked to or anything, but definitely know from Skate Twitter. So that was rad. Highly recommend that. I'm stoked on spring. It's been a very wet and cold winter here in Oregon. So the sun is out and the streets are dry. So stoked on that, and stoked on sharp knives. This Christmas, I got a couple of kitchen knives that are very sharp. And I don't know, it's like I didn't know how dull my knives were until I got these sharp knives. And it really just makes cutting things way better. So get yourself a sharp knife, and you'll be happy. You'll be stoked as well. That's it for our show this week. Be sure to check out mostlyskateboarding.net for links to the things that we talked about. We talked about a lot of stuff. And other show notes. Until next time, you can keep up with us all week online. Jose, where can the people find you? And where can the people find the book?
Oh, yeah, you can find me on social media at Vadi Party, one word. And you can get the book at your local bookstore or my website, josevadi.com or softskull.com. Appreciate the support. Patrick, where can the people find you?
You can find me on Instagram at Pikagongo, on Twitter at Colonel K Speaks, and doing stuff with the Harold Hunter Foundation. Mike, where can the people find you on the internet?
If I'm going to be on it, I'm under the handle, over the handle, who knows, at M Munzenrider Templeton. Where can the people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Mostly Skate and on Instagram at Mostly Skateboarding. We will see you guys next week.
Sky is a sea of darkness when there is no sun. Sky is a sea of darkness when there is no sun to light the way. When there is no sun to light the way, there is no day. There is no day. There's only darkness. Eternal sea of darkness. Sky is a sea of darkness when there is no sun. Sky is a sea of darkness when there is no sun to light the way. When there is no sun to light the way, there is no day. There is no day. Sky is a sea of darkness. when there is no sun to light the way. When there is no sun to light the way, there is no day. Darkness, eternal sea of darkness, eternal sea of darkness.